The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Wandsworth Radio. You are listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour. In the studio this evening, you have me, Aisha. Matt is with us again.
Good evening.
And today we have Alex Pankhurst.
Hello, 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 hello.
He's a voice that we don't often hear, but he's filling in because a lot of people are away this bank holiday weekend.
Oh, burn.
That's not a burn.
It's not a burn.
People are allowed to go away.
Are they allowed to go away?
We're just very committed, Matt and I.
They're away doing arts things.
Yes, of course. So coming up on the show today, we have part two of The Whistling Room. If you're listening to us a fortnight ago, then you would have heard part one. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up at the end of the show. We are also going to be hearing some reviews because last fortnight we were talking to Vicky and Ellie and Vicky were just about to head up to Edinburgh Fringe. So they've gone and seen something ridiculous, like 14 plays.
Something like 14 shows in about 2 days, I think.
What?
Yeah, 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. Is that possible?
Apparently. I was very, very surprised about it. But, so Vicky's done us a pre-record this week, and we're going to hear some reviews of the shows that they saw. We're also going to hear some new writing and also a review from Helen. And she's been to see Cypher's production of the two Chekhov plays that they've done recently at the Proud Archivist. But the first thing that we are going to go straight into is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
What have you done, Matt? You've teased us a fortnight ago with what you were going to be reviewing.
I was so pleased with myself for actually knowing what I was going to go and see. I said I was going to see American Ultra because all the posters said it would be out in time, and the posters lied.
Did they lie?
The poster said it was out on August 27th, which was this Friday just gone, mm-hmm. and I haven't been able to find a single cinema showing it.
Everything's just against you. You try and be prepared, you try and have answers for me, and it just never works.
So I'll preempt your usual question. Uh-huh. Next show, I will review American Ultra, but this time I caught up on... In fact, it was against me even more, because I thought I would do Mistress America to try and do... Mm-hmm. sort of a slightly indie movie in between all the blockbusters. I couldn't find that playing anywhere either. It's too indie. So I caught up on Inside Out, which has been out for a little while, mm-hmm. but I thought it was probably worth going to see.
Yeah.
Seeing whether the hype was deserved. So this movie's been, I don't know whether you've found this, but I found that it's been a little bit oversaturated in the advertising.
Yes. I'm not sure if we said it actually on air or if this was like in studio banter when we're off the air and listening to pre-records, but I was saying that I found it to be quite odd that it's all over Sky adverts.
Yeah.
And is it Sky or BT?
Sky Broadband has some sort of deal,
yeah.
Where the characters from Inside Out are advertising Sky Broadband.
Yeah.
And I don't even watch live TV with adverts in, and I've still found I'm oversaturated by these characters.
They are everywhere. Yeah,
they
billboards.
Are everywhere.
They're on all the billboards. Yeah. It's very bizarre.
And it was a combination of that and the very first trailer that I saw for it, which was actually an entire scene from the movie as a little preview scene, as a teaser trailer, made it seem like it was going to be quite simplistic and a bit reductionist, maybe. So the concept of it is everybody's got these little emotion people living in their heads who have a console that controls what you do, and so you have like a joy, a sadness, an anger, a fear, and a disgust running your console. And that preview scene was a conversation at the dinner table, a mum, a dad, and a little girl. And it kept zooming into the mum and the dad, and it just seemed like it was going to be sort of gender stereotype central. So the mum is pining over the Brazilian helicopter pilot she thinks she should have married, and the dad is not listening to anything the mum's saying and is just thinking about sports. And it just seemed like it was going to be really lazy. Thankfully, it's not that. That is a scene from the movie, and I think that scene is a misstep. And I think overall it does, when it is weakest, when it zooms into secondary characters' heads. But the main character, the little girl, Riley, 11-year-old girl, all the stuff in her head is much better handled. So it had kicked in my cynicism, but it then overcame it. So it is directed by Pete Docter, who also directed Up and Monsters Inc. So he's a guy who knows what he's doing, yeah. And he especially is a guy who knows how to make you turn on the waterworks.
Oh, I feel a question coming.
Not till a bit later.
Okay.
So the basic setup, and I say basic, it's a sort of a simple thing, and then it layers up. So Alex, did you ever read The Numbskulls in the Beano?
I was going to say, is it like The Numbskulls in the Beano?
So in The Numbskulls, concept of The Numbskulls comic was in your head are five little people, but they were senses rather than emotions.
You had Blinky. The guy who controlled the nose and the tongue and the rest of it.
So it's a similar thing to that, except with emotions this time.
Okay.
But it's not a... It starts with that very simple concept and then kind of builds from there. So they're all in control of the console, and every time Riley experiences something, it creates a memory, which is this little sort of glass blob. If it's a particularly strong memory, then it might become a core memory and actually start to create a part of her personality and sort of power a part of her personality. And everything seems to be going great until she's uprooted from her home and her friends and her sports team and her school, and her parents take her to live in a brand new city. And that event destabilizes everything inside her head. Throws all that whole system of core memories and personality and stuff out of the window, and her joy and her sadness end up lost in the back of her mind, and trying to get back to the console where they have to control her. So it's this grand metaphor of she's moved away from her home, or what she considers to be her home, where all her formative memories were formed. And it is suddenly sort of all mixed up and only really able to react with anger, fear, or disgust to everything. So,
classic 11-year-old.
Yeah. So you have the outside story where everything is going wrong in her life because all of these slightly negative emotions are in control of her. And you have the inside story of all of them running around going, what on earth are we doing? Because Joy was the one who was always in charge because she was a happy little girl. And meanwhile, joy and sadness are in the back of her mind trying to get back, and also bonding while they're at it, because the setup has always been that everybody has had a role except sadness. Nobody can quite work out what sadness is for, especially Joy, who is the one who is in charge. So she's always sort of pushing sadness off to the sidelines. And so part of the story is about Joy learning kind of what sadness's value is. And that she is as valid an emotion as all of the other ones. So it's this very simple thing of you have these five emotions and they control you. And then it builds and builds and builds on that with sort of long-term memory banks and islands of personality. And sort of that it builds in a quite a subtle kind of logical way as the film goes through. And like I say, the only real... there's not a huge amount to criticise. The only real missteps are when it very occasionally zooms into other people's heads where it's a bit less developed, and sort of things not quite making sense. Like it seems like Dad's anger little person is kind of the team leader, and the mum's sadness seems to be the team leader, but that doesn't seem to come out in there. It doesn't actually seem to come out in their outward personalities that he is an anger-driven person or she is a sadness-driven person. So. Not sure, but the Riley stuff does work. Like I say, it's all about this reconciliation of joy and sadness, recognition that sadness is a valid emotion, and that there's a thing running all the way through that all of these formative memories, if sadness gets too close to them, she might contaminate them, and they might turn from happy memories into sad memories. And so there's a thread running through of it. Actually, maybe by the end of the movie, maybe that wouldn't be such a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The recognition that sadness has a purpose. Sadness is how you tell other people that you're not okay, and that you need and that you need some comfort and you need some help. And it's also sort of the cathartic value of it, that you have a good cry and you feel better afterwards. So, and it, I feel like it's a potentially quite a timely message, given that that we you keep seeing news stories about sort of the incidence of mental health issues like depression are higher and higher in young people, and there's a lot of pressure on sort of younger generations to be, why aren't you happy with your lot in life, especially if you're sort of in a sort of privileged American background like this family is. Why aren't you happier with your lot in life? And so it, the central message of the movie is actually it is okay to not be 100% happy all the time. You can be sad sometimes. And it's just as well that it gives that message, because it means you don't feel quite so bad about bawling at the movie itself.
So,
and I know, because I know we, Vicky's not in the studio this week, but I know she saw it just before our previous show, and she, I think she and Dave both cried their eyes out at it.
Cry.
And I certainly wept a single manly tear.
Of course you did.
As is your wont.
So I wanted to, I was going to open this up because I know the director also directed Up, and that is another movie that a lot of people say makes them cry. And I wondered if there are other movies that, that you guys have particularly
Up was
had,
definitely,
that, had that response to.
Definitely cried in Up. That
it's
was
a traumatic
thing.
30 minutes.
I think Pixar is just really good at doing that kind of stuff.
And
where
I do feel like this is Disney Pixar back on form.
Yes. And I think it's interesting talking about it as, you know, a fundamental level of, you know, it's broken up into happiness and sadness and dealing with all those emotions. But, like, from a children's point of view, is it fun? Cause,
it is. It's hugely fun.
Okay, good.
Because
we're talking about it as, like, you know, it's quite sad and it's very complex and quite human. And I think that's really cool for, you know, parents to go along and take their kids, because the kids are like, oh, this is a really cool Pixar thing, Mum. Let's go and see it. But then the mums and dads are kind of sitting there going, oh, God, my 11-year-old is dealing with all of this stuff, which is really good. So it's doing that classic Pixar thing of double-pronging it, like,
message
fun
for both,
fun for the kids, think about your lives and what you're doing in a parenting kind of world.
This is one of the plot threads in kind of the outside plot, is that, you know, the parents feel like they're failing if she's not happy all the time.
And that's so tragic.
Therefore, she feels like she's failing them if she's not happy. Yeah. And that's why she's sort of suppressing all the sadness.
That's so interesting. Yeah. But yeah, no, going back to the crying thing, I think we had a bit of a chat about this before.
Yeah.
I think we sort of decided that there's very specific things for me in terms of crying in films. So it's either like if there's a dog involved, that's me gone. Not really, you know, don't really care about the human level of stuff, just the animals, really.
For me, it's always father and son stuff, like Mufasa dying in Lion King is a classic. You can't watch that and be like, and the start of Finding Nemo gets me every time.
I wonder
every
what
time.
It is about animated movies, whether it's just that the animated things tend to be more targeted at kids and tend to be slightly more broad brush in terms of emotions and therefore more likely to hit, or whether there's something about
animation
itself.
Is it maybe you go in with your guard down because you're like, it's just a fun kids film.
Yeah, I think, there's a strong element of that there, definitely.
Yeah, you're just not prepared.
You're not ready.
But then again, actually, we were saying in the studio, which I found quite funny the other week, everyone was saying about how Toy Story 3 really got them. And I had no emotional response to that whatsoever, and I felt really bad about saying that. But just didn't do anything for me. My dad cried. I was sitting next to my dad. He cried. I didn't.
Of course he did, because it was a very emotional film.
Matt, what's yours? Do you have a specific thing, or is it just... When was the last time you cried in a movie, apart from...
Oh, the last... I don't know about... I'm not sure about movies. The last time I cried, like, at a piece of media was Sense8 on Netflix, the Wachowskis TV show.
Okay.
Which was just sort of characters helping each other out.
It's moments of
it's heroism that always gets me. Like, I think I welled up at the end of The Winter Soldier as well, which is not...
Is that camaraderie?
It is that. It's not a movie that I think is calculated for that weepiness in the same way as things like Inside Out.
I know
Out
for
are.
A fact, actually, that's Ellie's pitfall as well, camaraderie.
Yeah.
She really gets welled up.
When
it's, you know, a lot of people getting together and, like, everyone's cheering, like, especially, like, sports stuff, you know. Not a huge sports fan, but when there's that, you know, final thing with all everyone's getting really excited.
So the manager's team talk, like, really psyching them up and saying, you can do this, you're the
best.
That
gets me.
Okay.
This is getting a little bit...
Music obviously plays a huge part as well. I know a lot of people said that they felt like the score... War Horse, particularly, that the score in War Horse sort of almost emotionally manipulated them into crying. And there's certainly a lot of that in Inside Out as well. The music plays a huge part.
Yeah. I'm very excited to see it now. I think that we definitely need to do that You've talked me into it, Matt. I'm not
I should
really
just mention. So Joy is Amy Poehler. She's great.
Yes.
Sadness. I'd never heard of her. Phyllis Smith. She was in the American version of The Office. She's great in it.
Phyllis Smith. Who did she play in The Office?
This says she plays Phyllis Vance.
Oh yes,
it's the same name.
Yeah, she's married to Vance Refrigerators, I believe. So yeah, no, I'm aware of that character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
But she's good. She's sort of she's kind of morose, without being like completely unwatchable and
without being morbid.
Which sounds like damning with faint praise, but she is very good in it.
Mm. Well, thank you, Matt, for that excellent review. As always, in a fortnight's time, you're going to hear Matt reviewing
American Ultra.
American Ultra.
Actually, this time, provided the cinemas haven't lied again.
Yeah, you got to see it this week, though. Yeah. Otherwise, it'll be over by the time you.
I've been watching other Jesse Eisenberg, Kristen Stewart films to
get in the mood.
Are they going to be in a Woody Allen film?
She certainly is. I don't know if he is.
Let's please not talk about Woody Allen on this
show. Batman v Superman, isn't he?
Oh, yes, he is, isn't he? Lex Luthor. Yeah. Oh.
I will actually go on a Woody Allen rant, and no one needs that.
Moving
swiftly on, Alex is in the studio today, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what he's doing next as an actor.
As an actor.
You're an actor.
Yeah, rather than like what I'm doing next today.
No, yeah, not just doing what he's doing on this bank holiday. You are in the upcoming production of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, I am. It's going to be at the Tea House Theatre in Vauxhall, which is it's a tea house. It's in Vauxhall, and it's also a theatre, but it does lots of other sort of musical stuff and arts things. But you can go there just for brunch, cake. It also has a policy of no coffee. So it's like no other hot beverages really other than tea.
I will not go there.
That doesn't like it.
I had a similar misgivings, but it's a really, really lovely space. It used to be an old strip venue way back when, and then the people who owned it gutted it and turned it into this tea house. It's all very family friendly, I can confirm that the cake is great.
Oh, good.
They do get great cake.
So tell us about maybe the production. That
you're in. But it all ties into the production, because the production's set in the 1930s. It's set in a tea house. It's only an hour long, so the script's been very, very much pared down. I'm playing both Bottom and Demetrius, and it's just meant to be a really good fun romp. I think it's very much it's quite a bold reimagining of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's one of the most popularly done plays, and it has all the classic moments in it, but it allows you to come along. This particular show has allowed you to come along and dress up in 1930s garb, so you kind of get involved in the police. It's site specific because it's set in a tea room. You're in a tea room. You're encouraged to enjoy the beverages that they serve. There's going to be a tea dance afterwards as well, so you can.
Is a tea dance?
I said tea dance.
It's what it sounds like. It's
dancing
it's
with tea.
Yeah, dancing. It's like dancing with wolves, but with tea.
What?
You do like a bit that. Of ballroom dancing, and then there's dancing stops, and you have some tea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You do some more ballroom dancing.
So in my head, it was people dancing with a teapot in either hand.
No.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, try and not spill it. That's like it's like a challenge as well as a dance.
But yeah,
I'm glad
so
we cleared that up.
You get an opportunity to dance afterwards, and if anyone's ever seen Jeeves and Wooster, it's very much in that mould. It's a good fun romp. Tickets are only £10, and I think it's something that people can come along and just really get involved and get a lot of enjoyment out of. I'm having a lot of fun rehearsing it. Having said that it's one of the most popular plays, I've never seen a production of Midsummer Night's Dream or been in one, and most actors have been, so it's been really interesting for me because I'm like, I have no idea what's going on, really. So it's been really good fun. So yes, please come along. It's on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of September, and it starts at 8 p.m.
Yes, we are. I think a crew of us Blackshaw guys are going on the 11th, which is the Friday. Also, the Angela Shepherd, who is one of our friends of Blackshaw, who was in character, which we put on at start of the year? Was that long ago? Oh no, it was last year actually. Angela was one of the leads in a Blackshaw production of character, and she is heralding this production of A Midsummer Night's Dream that's really, really difficult to say quickly.
Yeah.
Who's she playing in it?
She is playing Helena. and Titania.
She's a fantastic actress as well. So come along, tickets are £10, and where can they get them? They can get them
at... can get them online.
theteahousetheatre.co.uk. Thanks, Alex, for giving us info about the next production that you're in. Next up, we are going to hear some new writing, which was performed early... No, actually, at the end of last year. It's called Have You Seen Spider-Man 2?
I'll just ask her. She walks in, I go, Have you seen Spider-Man 2 yet? Why? Geez, well, I'm fond of the franchise and I wanted to talk about the issues it raises and how they relate to the real world. Huh. Yeah, that's awful. Literally nobody talks like that. Why would she ask why? You're worrying too much about this. She'll just say yes or no. Then we talk about Spider-Man, then we segue. Easy.
So, what do you feel like eating?
Oh, hey babe, have you seen Spider-Man 2 yet?
Not yet. Why? What?
Tea.
I'm sorry?
Tea. My tea is brewing, you see, and I've left it for too long now. I'll be ruined if I don't leave the room this instant to fix it.
I've just been in the kitchen. There isn't any tea brewing. What are you talking about?
Well, what I meant is that I need to brew some tea. Do you want any?
What? You didn't say anything like that.
Tea is a legitimate reason to leave a room. So yeah, we were talking about Spider-Man, Sarah. I mean, the whole great power, great responsibility thing he has with Uncle Ben. His uncle dies, and he promises himself that he'll fight crime. Quite a commitment. It's crazy, right? Could you see yourself promising to something life-changing like that? I'm sure you have some ideas. Well, let's discuss.
Weren't we just talking about tea?
Hey! Maybe we were, whatever. But let's get back to this oath thing, though. I think we could have one of our classic philosophy discussions. You love those. Set the world straight. Yeah?
You're in a really funny mood today.
Sorry? Yeah, I guess so. Loud kettles. Can't hear people over them. Nuisance, right?
Yeah, okay.
Here we are. Tea as promised? What?
What?
Why are you looking at me?
I thought you were looking at me.
Well, yeah, but I'm looking at you because you're looking at me.
Fine. I guess nothing weird's going on then.
Just me being all over the place again.
Okay. Oh, are you up to date on Game of Thrones? This season has been really good so far. Sorry I haven't been watching it with you.
That's okay. And, not yet.
But you love that show. Which episode are you on?
I haven't actually managed to see any of this series.
Criminal? Why not?
I've just been kind of busy. Can we just...
That's no excuse. Tell you what, I'll grab my laptop. Let's catch you up.
I don't really know if I'm in the mood.
No boyfriend of mine will avoid Game of Thrones. I'll be right back.
This isn't going well. Right. I'll just bring the conversation back around to what we were talking about earlier. No problems. Okay, what was next? It'll be weird if I mention Spider-Man again, won't it? Yeah. Okay, it's fine. It really is. Keep it a little upbeat. I've got tons more topics ready to go. Natural, everyday topics. Brilliant.
So, are you ready to set sail back to Westeros? I see. You need a catch-up. Hang on, I found this great video on YouTube which goes through all of what happened in season 3.
Dr. Faustus!
What?
No. Okay, next we're supposed to be Batman. You can't go straight from Spider-Man to Faustus.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. What's going on?
Well, the thing with Spider-Man is he feels guilty about not stopping the mugger guy from doing a robbery which leads to Uncle Ben being killed. After that, he promises himself that he'll stop that happening in the... future. He makes a pretty big commitment, right? I mean, he spends his life fighting crime, yeah? And Batman is similar because he... Hang on.
Look, just stop. Whatever this is, just stop and we can talk about
it. Batman's parents are killed when he's a little kid and he makes a commitment to clean up the city. Both of these are similar because it's involuntary, right? They didn't choose for it to happen. But what about those characters who did willingly enter into a contract? And this... brings us back
John.
What did I say again?
Dr. Faustus, yes.
Just...
Unlike the previous characters, Dr. Faustus willingly enters into a contract with the devil.
But
he chooses to change the course of his life permanently.
That is enough!
I'm sorry. So could you ever see yourself doing something like that?
What?
Well, could you do it? Could you legally bind yourself into a contract that's going to last your whole life?
I mean,
taking the devil part out of the equation, could you do something like that? Could you swear to something that you were locked into until you died?
Are you actually asking me that? Could I sign some sort of lifelong contract? Why?
It doesn't matter. I just need to know.
You're starting to scare me a bit.
So? Well, I guess I'll just have to take that as a no, then.
It's a no until you explain to me what this is about. Have you done something? Are you in trouble?
No, of course not. So it's a no, which is fine because there are many arguments against the institution of marriage. I mean, retaining individual liberties, equality between the sexes, government control...
Wait, hang on. Did you just say marriage? This was about marriage. What the f***, John? Was that a f***ing proposal? Are you f***ing insane?
Yeah. When you put it like that...
What were you thinking?
Well, I was nervous and... I just wanted to ease you into a discussion about serious commitments. It didn't really go as I planned.
Understatement of the f***ing century.
But do you get it, though? Spider-Man, Batman, Faust, marriage. Easy, really.
This is just you all over, isn't it? You had to have a plan for absolutely everything. I bet you had a response ready for if I'd said yes as well.
Well, of course. Do you want to hear it?
No, I don't want to hear it. You don't... get it, do you? You can't do this to people. You don't have to script everything out, you know? You could have just done what normal people do. Take me out for a meal or something. Surprise me with a romantic gesture. Actually, propose.
We could totally do something like that, if you like. Where do you want to go?
No, you know what? F*** you.
Sarah?
Come on, John. You clearly don't respect me enough to leave it up to me. You felt you had to trick me into agreeing to it before you risked actually asking the question. That is properly insane. This is the sort of stuff you read about on the internet and wonder whether it's true because it's absolutely crazy.
Now I know that you can't forgive me, but understand that I did this because I love you. I didn't want to put you in a position where you felt you couldn't say no. And, well, I know that was wrong of me, but...
Are you monologuing? Did you write that as well in case I didn't go for your foolproof plan?
Sorry. I mean, no, I didn't. But it sounded like... I'm sorry. Sorry.
I really should have expected something like this. It can never be normal, can it? Oh, you're such an idiot.
You know what? I'll go. I'll crash somewhere else tonight. Can we at least talk properly tomorrow? I'll make it up to you. I mean, I'll try. If you feel like maybe one day...
What are you talking about? I didn't say no.
Hang on. Aren't you really mad?
Of course I am. And if you ever pull anything like that again, I'll... Well, I don't know what I'll do, but it'll be truly horrible.
So what are you saying?
Let's just go out somewhere. Have you seen Spider-Man 2 yet?
That was a piece of new writing called Have You Seen Spider-Man 2, which was performed quite recently at the end of last year at one of Blackshaw's new writing nights. The next new writing night, actually, is coming up at the end of September. So if you would like to be involved or give us any of your writing that you'd like to see performed on the night, then you can head over to blackshawonline.com and head to the new writing night page, and we will explain everything to you from there. Now coming up, we're going into Arts Thing of the Week. Now, Ellie and Vicky went to Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago now, and Vicky has put together some reviews from the shows that they saw, and we're going to listen to them now.
This week's Hot Thing of the Week is a roundup of everything that we saw when we went to Edinburgh Fringe. Over 4 days, we saw a wide variety of things, including stand-up, sketch comedy, musical comedy, beautifully woven narrative comedy, a cappella, live alchemy, physical stunts, and even some chat pop, as well as some fantastic improv as well. The best of the best of the weekend has to start at the beginning, with the marvellous Max and Ivan. Their hilarious hour-long show tells the tale of a small town called Sudley-on-Sea that's about to meet its maker. The end is nigh for the people of this tiny, dismal town, and the pair took us on a hilarious ride through the final hours of the people of Sudley, seamlessly switching between hundreds of fantastic and vibrant characters. We laughed, we cried, we were disturbed by a van in a leotard, and it was frankly quite brilliant. The next show to mention has to be our good friend Will Seward, who had a jolly good go at alchemy, and he really did. It was hilarious, marvellous, and of course alchemical. He'd done the research, bought the equipment, and had prepared a fully hilarious 50 minutes of pseudo-scientific madness. In Will's own Brian Blessed voiced words, "Science says what I'm trying to do is impossible, so I reckon we have a 50-50 chance of success." It's perhaps needless to say that we didn't make gold, but we did have a lot of fun, chanted Shake It Off in Latin, and wore some protective eyewear. Next up to mention has to be the Noise Next Door, who were, in Ellie's words, a very safe pair of improv hands, and indeed they were. In equal parts slick and hysterical, complete with dodgy accents and joyful onstage bickering, and with an improvised boy band-style song that started and ended the show, it was a hilarious musical joy and great value for money improv. It would be remiss of me not to talk about the four, yes, four, absolutely marvellous sketch shows we saw over the weekend. First up was In Cahoots, who are friends of Blackshaw, Paul and Luke, were on top form with their show Two White Guys, with pithy, often charming and always hilarious sketches that frequently dealt with some pretty serious political issues, with perfectly pitched satire and well-timed punchlines. Paul's Northern Poet was a particular treat, and the wonderfully on-point Doctor Informs Woman She's Unfortunately Pregnant with a Girl sketch about sexism were just really amazing sketches. The second thing to mention is the beyond brilliant Peter Males, who are a funny foursome, and they are Ed Fringe regulars. They put together a best of from their sketches over the last 6 years. Every sketch was absolutely brilliant, flawlessly executed, but the Who on Earth is Michael Collins sketch about the guy no one remembers alongside Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong because he never walked on the moon was genuinely inspired. We also saw some brilliant ladies of comedy in the form of Kitten Killers, who'll be very much worth catching at their next show in London if you like brilliantly unapologetic and bawdy comedy sketches as well as glow sticks. The last sketch mentioned goes to John Poynting and Ed Eales-White and their show Bucket. This is a mad and meta set of sketches with John and Ed often playing themselves as warring comedy partners. Ed as the auteur desperate for John to take performing seriously, and John as the madcap physical theatre lover wanting to try out new characters and get the energy in the room up by wearing a silver suit and dancing about like a crazy person. Their stage combat expert sketch, where they both play totally useless and incredibly nervous stage combat experts, was one of the funniest things I saw at the Fringe. A final mention goes to the two stand-ups we saw over the weekend. James Acaster was, as expected, totally deadpan brilliant from the start of his show when he revealed he knew what we'd all come for, which was apparently celebrity gossip, which he had in spades about the Chilean miners, through his time serving on a jury where he developed abject hatred for one juror who he decided was the worst, or at least in the bottom 50 worldwide. We finished our tour of Ed Fringe with the so good it's hard to put into words comedy stand-up of Ed Gamble. It was just him, a mic, a clipboard and an iPod. His show Lawman is all about his love and appreciation for rules and law. So much of this show had us rolling in the aisles, or so to speak anyway, we were actually in a pub basement with no aisles at all, but him reading out his film script for a crime film about a cop who absolutely follows the rules up to and including not pursuing the killer of his wife and child because he understands that it's a serious conflict of interest was by far my favourite moment. Although much of what we saw and loved was comedy, we did see the full variety, from prop-laden theatricality, physical theatre, puppetry and song to bare-bones performance in sketch, where all that was required was a couple of stools, a mic stand and the talent of those on stage. I calculated that I think we saw around 55 talented performers at the Fringe over the weekend, which is really just a fraction of the enormous amount of talent you can see there. It's an incredible experience every time and fully recommended. If you can't make it to Edinburgh, though, look out for all of these incredible performers at a venue closer to home, as you'll find loads of them doing their funny thing at locations in London.
That was Vicky Weston talking to us about all of the shows that she saw at the Edinburgh Fringe a couple of weeks ago, and all of us in the studio were just laughing along to her very, very funny reviews. So hopefully in a fortnight she will be in the studio to elaborate a little bit more on the shows that she experienced with Ellie. Coming up on the show, we are going to hear Helen Johnson. She has been to see a Chekhov double bill by Cyphers, a company that we are actually working with in the new year, to bring you a radio play, seven-parter, actually, of Great Expectations.
A radio serialization.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be long and consistent, and you guys are going to love it. and yeah, so this review is of a Chekhov double bill, and it's got a brief introduction by Marcus, the creative director of Cyphers.
So I'm artistic director of a company called Cyphers. We started last year. What we're really interested in is sort of empowering audiences, basically, to use their imaginations. The whole ethos of the company started from the chorus of the prologue of Henry V, which was our first play that we did in October, which says, "Let us ciphers to this greater compt on your imaginary forces work." So essentially the actors are there as a kind of go-between the text and the audience, and they're just there to encourage the audience to see the world that the actors are creating for them. And that's where the whole ethos of the company started, really.
The people are friendly at the Proud Archivist, except, perhaps, those you were introduced to by Cyphers during Chekhov's comedic double of The Proposal and The Boar. Starting with The Proposal, an eccentric piece with characters presented larger than life, making faults so plain it's no wonder they are virtually unavoidable. These three do have their charm, however, and the audience enjoys their company, some more closely than others, through light-touch, warmly executed audience interaction. Next up is The Boar. Utterly madcap, this is like a Meg Ryan rom-com with guns, in the best possible way. It's lovely to see this small cast stretching their skills by presenting us with a whole new set of characters. All in all, a thoroughly enjoyable evening. Literary classics are in safe hands with Cyphers. Here at Blackshaw, we enjoyed their Great Expectations and now the Chekhov double. Next up is Henry V at the end of October, and we'll see you there. In the new year, we'll be bringing you a co-production with Cyphers right here on the Arts Hour. We've recorded a seven-part radio epic of their Great Expectations and can't wait to share this with you. Editing is in process right now, and we should be able to get you part one in the first week of January.
Yes, that was Helen Johnson reiterating what I was just saying before on the Blackshaw Arts Hour, that we are going to be bringing you Great Expectations as a radio play on the air in January of 2016. Now, if you were listening to the show a fortnight ago, you would have heard our lovely Matt Boothman, who's in the studio,
hello,
reading you a lovely Carnacki story called The Whistling Room, and we are playing you part two right now.
This is part two of The Whistling Room, A Tale of Carnacki the Ghost Finder by William Hope Hodgson.
All this time, every night, and sometimes most of the night, the hooning whistling of the room was intolerable. It was as if an intelligence there knew that steps were being taken against it, and piped and hooned in a sort of mad, mocking contempt. I tell you, it was as extraordinary as it was horrible. Time after time I went along, tiptoeing noiselessly on stockinged feet to the sealed door, for I always kept the room sealed. I went at all hours of the night, and often the whistling inside would seem to change to a brutally malignant note, as though the half-animate monster saw me plainly through the shut door. And all the time, the shrieking, hooning whistling would fill the whole corridor, so that I used to feel a precious lonely chap messing about in there with one of hell's mysteries. And every morning I would enter the room and examine the different hairs and seals. You see, after the first week I had stretched parallel hairs across all the walls of the room and along the ceiling, but over the floor, which was of polished stone, I had set out little colourless wafers, tacky side uppermost. Each wafer was numbered, and they were arranged after a definite plan, so that I should be able to trace the exact movements of any living thing that went across the floor. You will see that no material being or creature could possibly have entered that room without leaving many signs to tell me about it. But nothing was ever disturbed, and I began to think that I should have to risk an attempt to stay the night in the room in the electric pentacle. Yet, mind you, I knew that it would be a crazy thing to do, but I was getting stumped and ready to do anything. Once about midnight I did break the seal on the door and have a quick look in, but I tell you, the whole room gave one mad yell and seemed to come towards me in a great belly of shadows, as if the walls had bellied in toward me. Of course, that must have been fancy. Anyway, the yell was sufficient, and I slammed the door and locked it, feeling a bit weak down my spine. You know the feeling. And then, when I had got to that state of readiness for anything, I made something of a discovery. It was about 1 in the morning, and I was walking slowly round the castle, keeping in the soft grass. I had come under the shadow of the east front, and far above me I could hear the vile, hooning whistle of the room, up in the darkness of the unlit wing. Then, suddenly, a little in front of me I heard a man's voice, speaking low, but evidently in glee. "By George, you chaps, but I wouldn't care to bring a wife home in that," it said, in the tone of the cultured Irish. Someone started to reply, but there came a sharp exclamation and then a rush, and I heard footsteps running in all directions. Evidently the men had spotted me. For a few seconds I stood there, feeling an awful ass. After all, they were at the bottom of the haunting. Do you see what a big fool it made me seem? I had no doubt but that they were some of Tassock's rivals, and here I had been feeling in every bone that I had hit a real bad, genuine case. And then, you know, there came the memory of hundreds of details that made me just as much in doubt again. Anyway, whether it was natural or abnatural, there was a great deal yet to be cleared up. I told Tassock next morning what I had discovered, and through the whole of every night for 5 nights we kept a close watch round the east wing. But there was never a sign of anyone prowling about, and all the time, almost from evening to dawn, that grotesque whistling would hoon incredibly far above us in the darkness. On the morning after the 5th night, I received a wire from here which brought me home by the next boat. I explained to Tassock that I was simply bound to come away for a few days, but told him to keep up the watch round the castle. One thing I was very careful to do, and that was to make him absolutely promise never to go into the room between sunset and sunrise. I made it clear to him that we knew nothing definite yet one way or the other, and if the room were what I had first thought it to be, it might be a lot better to him to die first than to enter it after dark. When I got here and had finished my business, I thought you chaps would be interested, and also I wanted to get it all spread out clear in my mind, so I rung you up. I am going over again tomorrow, and when I get back I ought to have something pretty extraordinary to tell you. By the way, there is a curious thing I forgot to tell you. I tried to get a phonographic record of the whistling, but it simply produced no impression on the wax at all. That is one of the things that has made me feel queer, I can tell you. Another extraordinary thing is that the microphone will not magnify the sound, will not even transmit it, seems to take no account of it and acts as if it was non-existent. I am absolutely and utterly stumped up to the present. I am a wee bit curious to see whether any of your dear clever heads can make daylight of it. I cannot, not yet. He rose to his feet. "Good night, all," he said, and began to usher us out abruptly, but without offence, into the night. A fortnight later he dropped each of us a card, and you can imagine that I was not late this time. When we arrived, Carnacki took us straight to dinner, and when we had finished, and all made ourselves comfortable, he began again, where he had left off. "Now, just listen quietly, for I have got something pretty queer to tell you. I got back late at night, and I had to walk up to the castle, as I had not warned them that I was coming. It was bright moonlight, so that the walk was rather a pleasure than otherwise. When I got there, the whole place was in darkness, and I thought I would take a walk round outside to see whether Tassock or his brother was keeping watch. But I could not find them anywhere, and concluded that they had got tired of it and gone off to bed. As I returned across the front of the east wing, I caught the hooning whistling of the room, coming down strangely through the stillness of the night. It had a queer note in it, I remember, low and constant, queerly meditative. I looked up at the window, bright in the moonlight, and got a sudden thought to bring a ladder from the stable-yard and try to get a look into the room through the window. With this notion I hunted round at the back of the castle among the straggle of offices, and presently found a long, fairly light ladder, though it was heavy enough for one, goodness knows. And I thought at first that I should never get it reared. I managed at last, and let the ends rest very quietly against the wall, a little below the sill of the larger window. Then, going silently, I went up the ladder. Presently, I had my face above the sill and was looking in alone with the moonlight. Of course, the queer whistling sounded louder up there, but it still conveyed that peculiar sense of something whistling quietly to itself, can you understand? Though, for all the meditative lowness of the note, the horrible gargantuan quality was distinct. A mighty parody of the human, as if I stood there and listened to the whistling from the lips of a monster with a man's soul. And then, you know, I saw something. The floor in the middle of the huge empty room was puckered upward in the centre into a strange soft-looking mound, parted at the top into an ever-changing hole that pulsated to that great gentle hooning. At times, as I watched, I saw the heaving of the indented mound gap across with a queer inward suction, as with the drawing of an enormous breath. Then the thing would dilate and pout once more to the incredible melody. And suddenly, as I stared, dumb, it came to me that the thing was living. I was looking at two enormous blackened lips, blistered and brutal, there in the pale moonlight. Abruptly, they bulged out to a vast, pouting mound of force and sound, stiffened and swollen, and hugely massive and clean-cut in the moonbeams. And a great sweat lay heavy on the vast upper lip. In the same moment of time, the whistling had burst into a mad, screaming note that seemed to stun me, even where I stood outside of the window. And then, the following moment, I was staring blankly at the solid, undisturbed floor of the room. Smooth, polished stone flooring from wall to wall, and there was an absolute silence. You can picture me staring into the quiet room and knowing what I knew. I felt like a sick, frightened kid and wanted to slide quietly down the ladder and run away. But in that very instant I heard Tassock's voice calling to me from within the room for help. Help! My God, but I got such an awful dazed feeling, and I had a vague, bewildered notion that, after all, it was the Irishman who had got him in there and were taking it out of him. And then the call came again, and I burst the window and jumped in to help him. I had a confused idea that the call had come from within the shadow of the great fireplace, and I raced across to it, but there was no one there. Tassock! I shouted, and my voice went empty-sounding round the great apartment. And then, in a flash, I knew that Tassock had never called. I whirled round, sick with fear, toward the window, and as I did so, a frightful, exultant, whistling scream burst through the room. On my left, the end wall had bellied in toward me in a pair of gargantuan lips, black and utterly monstrous, to within a yard of my face. I fumbled for a mad instant at my revolver, not for it, but myself, for the danger was a thousand times worse than death. And then, suddenly, the unknown last line of the Sa-Ma ritual was whispered quite audibly in the room. Instantly, the thing happened that I have known once before. There came a sense as of dust falling continually and monotonously, and I knew that my life hung uncertain and suspended for a flash in a brief reeling vertigo of unseeable things. Then that ended, and I knew that I might live. My soul and body blended again, and life and power came to me. I dashed furiously at the window and hurled myself out head foremost, for I can tell you that I had stopped being afraid of death. I crashed down onto the ladder and slithered, grabbing and grabbing, and so came some way or other alive to the bottom. And there I sat in the soft wet grass, with the moonlight all about me, and far above, through the broken window of the room, there was a low whistling. That is the chief of it. I was not hurt, and I went round to the front and knocked Tassock up. When they let me in, we had a long yarn over some good whisky, for I was shaken to pieces, and I explained things as much as I could. I told Tassock that the room would have to come down, and every fragment of it burned in a blast furnace erected within a pentacle. He nodded. There was nothing to say. Then I went to bed. We turned a small army onto the work, and within 10 days that lovely thing had gone up in smoke, and what was left was calcined and clean. It was when the workmen were stripping the panelling that I got hold of a sound notion of the beginnings of that beastly development. Over the great fireplace, after the great oak panels had been torn down, I found that there was let into the masonry a scrollwork of stone, with on it an old inscription in ancient Celtic, that here in this room was burned Dian Tian Se, jester of King Alzoth, who made the Song of Foolishness upon King Ernor of the Seventh Castle. When I got the translation clear, I gave it to Tassock. He was tremendously excited, for he knew the old tale, and took me down to the library to look at an old parchment that gave the story in detail. Afterward, I found that the incident was well known about the countryside, but always regarded more as a legend than as history. And no one ever seemed to have dreamt that the old east wing of Ayastrae Castle was the remains of the ancient Seventh Castle. From the old parchment I gathered that there had been a pretty dirty job done away back in the years. It seems that King Alzoth and King Ernor had been enemies by birthright, as you might say truly, but that nothing more than a little raiding had occurred on either side for years, until Dian Tian Se had made the Song of Foolishness upon King Ernor, and sang it before King Alzoth, and so greatly was it appreciated that King Alzoth gave the jester one of his ladies to wife. Presently, all the people of the land had come to know the song, and so it came at last to King Ernor, who was so angered that he made war upon his old enemy, and took and burned him and his castle. But Dian Tian Se, the jester, he brought with him to his own place, and having torn his tongue out because of the song which he had made and sung, he imprisoned him in the room in the east wing, which was evidently used for unpleasant purposes, and the jester's wife he kept for himself, having a fancy for her prettiness. But one night Dian Tian Se's wife was not to be found, and in the morning they discovered her lying dead in her husband's arms, and he sitting, whistling the Song of Foolishness, for he had no longer the power to sing it. Then they roasted Dian Tian Se in the great fireplace, probably from that self-same galley iron which I have already mentioned. And until he died, Dian Tian Se ceased not to whistle the Song of Foolishness, which he could no longer sing. But afterward, in that room there was often heard at night the sound of something whistling, and there grew a power in that room so that none dared to sleep in it. And presently, it would seem, the king went to another castle, for the whistling troubled him. There you have it all. Of course, that is only a rough rendering of the translation of the parchment, but it sounds extraordinarily quaint, don't you think so? Yes, I said, answering for the lot. But how did the thing grow to such a tremendous manifestation? One of those cases of continuity of thought producing a positive action upon the immediate surrounding material, replied Carnacki. The development must have been going forward through centuries to have produced such a monstrosity. It was a true instance of Saiti'i manifestation, which I can best explain by likening it to a living spiritual fungus, which involves the very structure of the ether fibre itself, and, of course, in so doing, acquires an essential control over the material substance involved in it. It is impossible to make it plainer in a few words. What broke the seventh hair? Asked Taylor. But Carnacki did not know. He thought it was probably nothing but being too severely tensioned. He also explained that they had found out that the men who had run away had not been up to mischief, but had come over secretly merely to hear the whistling, which indeed had suddenly become the talk of the whole countryside. One other thing, said Arkwright. Have you any idea what governs the use of the unknown last line of the Saamaa ritual? I know, of course, that it was used by the abhuman priests in the incantation of Rai'i. But what used it upon your behalf, and what made it? You had better read Harzen's monograph and my addenda to it on astral and astral coordination and interference, said Carnacki. It is an extraordinary subject, and I can only say here that the human vibration may not be insulated from the astral, as is always believed to be the case in interferences by the abhuman, without immediate action being taken by those forces which govern the spinning of the outer circle. In other words, it is being proved time after time that there is some inscrutable protective force constantly intervening between the human soul, not the body, mind you, and the outer monstrosities. Am I clear? Yes, I think so, I replied. And you believe that the room had become the material expression of the ancient jester, that his soul, rotten with hatred, has bred into a monster, eh? I asked. Yes, said Carnacki, nodding. I think you've put my thought rather neatly. It is a queer coincidence that Miss Donoghue is supposed to be descended, so I have heard since, from the same King Ernor. It makes one think some curious thoughts, doesn't it? The marriage coming on, and the room waking to fresh life. If she had gone into that room ever, eh? It had waited a long time. Sins of the Fathers. Yes, I've thought of that. They're to be married next week, and I am to be best man, which is a thing I hate. And he won his bets, rather. Just think, if ever she had gone into that room. Pretty horrible, eh? He nodded his head grimly, and we four nodded back. Then he stood and took us collectively to the door, and presently thrust us forth in friendly fashion on the embankment and into the fresh night air. Good night, we all called back, and went to our various homes. If she had, eh? If she had. That is what I kept thinking.
That was part two of The Whistling Room, and we have come to the end of the show once again on this lovely Sunday evening, and it's the bank holiday, so that's exciting, so everyone's got Monday off. I'd like to thank Matt and Alex for being in the studio. Up next
Thank you too.
You're welcome, guys. Thanks for joining me. Up next on Wandsworth Radio is Kay with Business Bites, and we will see you in a fortnight's time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.